Most of us agree that there are some times in our practice, in our spiritual practice, we just don't always feel ecstatic, isn't it? Sometimes you just sort of don't feel it. So I'd like to go back a little bit in history and think about the author of the Vedas, Vyasadeva, who at a certain point also realized that he didn't feel joy. Even after doing so much service and writing so many books, he realized, you know, I don't feel joy. So for those of you who aren't familiar, Vyasadeva was a literary expansion of the Lord, who was born in the womb of Satyavati, begotten by the great sage Parasara. If you have read the Mahabharata, you will know the story surrounding the birth of Vyasadeva. If you haven't read the Mahabharata, please do. It's just a very exciting, dramatic book. It offers you the complete background to the Srimad Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita. And I know when I read it the first time, I couldn't put it down. It was better than any movie that I've ever seen, the Mahabharata. So much drama and intrigue around interpersonal relationships. I particularly recommend the version of the Mahabharata commented on by a devotee named Krishna Dharma. I think that's a really good thing. Maybe you have it here in your bookshop. So anyway, one morning, this Vyasadeva, he sat down on the banks of the river Sarasvati to meditate after he took his bath. And Vyasadeva was a great sage who could see the past, the present, and the future. And as he meditated on the human condition, he began to notice that increasingly there were irregularities developing in the world. For example, he noticed that how unlucky and short-lived humanity was becoming, and how dull-headed and impatient they were, particularly people who were faithless and they lacked the mode of goodness, and that people were lacking in natural capabilities and talents of all types. They didn't seem to have any special strengths in their character that clearly pointed them towards their mission in life. Sounds like today, kind of, right? In Kali Yuga, people don't really have a direction. They don't know what they should be doing. Lacking in the mode of goodness, they don't know what to do and what not to do, which is, says in the Bhagavad Gita, is a symptom of the mode of passion. So Vyasadeva, he started to contemplate how he could help, which is what a saintly person does when they see some suffering. They start to think, what can I do to benefit all people from all different ashrams and stages of life, something we call vanashram, varna ashram, the vocations and stages of life. So for many years, Vyasadeva, he worked very hard to share ancient wisdom to human society in order to help relieve their suffering due to not having any knowledge how the world works. Now, even today, we see that the main cause of human suffering is due to people not knowing how the world works. They just don't know. I didn't grow up with any kind of insight. Christianity didn't tell me, you know, there's a way, an order that the world should go. And if you follow that order of life, then your life will be a lot more simple, a lot more peaceful. And this is why on all levels of society, the world is broken in so many ways today. Just have a look. In another talk, I mentioned that when we buy something in a store, I don't know which talk it was, but when we buy something in a store, like a juice machine, or a computer, or a car, anything, name it, any kind of technology that you buy, it comes with a set of instructions, isn't it? You get a little thing in there that says, okay, make sure you don't put it in water, make sure you don't touch it when it's on, or whatever. And the instructions tell you how to operate the machine better, so it will be effective. And if we don't follow those instructions exactly, we run the risk of breaking it or wasting so much time in the long run. So Vyasadeva, he understood that the people, what they needed was some kind of access to instructions how best to live their life in the world in order to be happy. So he started to compile these Vedic books of wisdom, that explain how life in the material world works according to natural laws, which are actually God's laws. So in the beginning, there was one Vedic text that was divided into four. The Rig Veda was made up of the hymns praising the various demigods like Indra, the god of heaven, Agni, the god of fire, Varuna, the god of water, and so many others. It also contains the Gayatri Mantra and the prayer called the Purusha Shukta, which is a story about humankind. Yajurveda was a priestly handbook used to perform ritual sacrifices. The Samaveda consisted of chants and melodies to be sung during the worship and performance of these ritual sacrifices. The Atharva Veda contained hymns, mantras, and incantations that were used outside the scope of ritual sacrifices. And there were multiple divisions after that of the Vedas that told various contexts where you should chant this mantra at this place, you know, this mantra at that time, and then stories and instructions for sages who lived as hermits in the forest. Then there were something called Upangas that were subtexts in the Vedas that explained the arts and sciences according guided by natural law, like we have the Ayurveda, which is the science of natural healing and medicine, Gandharva Veda, the science of art and music and dance, Dhanurveda, the science of warfare and leadership, and Shilpa Veda, the science of architecture. Another name might be Vastu Shastra. I think other countries call it Feng Shui or whatever, but there's a science to all of these things, and people don't know it, and therefore there's so many imbalances in the society, because people don't know quite how the world works. In addition to all of those texts, there were various philosophical discussions or treaties, way too many to talk about tonight. I don't even want to start on that. But suffice it to say that Vyasadeva compiled a whole ton of literature just to try to help people understand how to navigate the material world in every possible context imaginable. And since there is a gazillion contexts possible in the material world, he ended up with a very voluminous literature that we call the Vedic Knowledge or Wisdom Text. So these books of wisdoms were originally orally transmitted from one master to the next by word of mouth. There was no need for books because in ancient times, people had pretty good memories because of their lack of sense gratification or their minimization or regulated life. But as Kali Yuga progressed, people's memories got shorter and shorter, so the Vedas were written down in order to pass them down through generations. One time I heard Srila Prabhupada say in a lecture to one of his disciples who was bringing in his tape recorder to record Srila Prabhupada, and he said that Krishna was providing technologies such as the tape recorder in those days. I don't even think they make them now, but in those days Prabhupada used a reel-to-reel tape recorder in order to help people remember him. I mean, he said these are Krishna's inspiration to help us remember because our memories are so short. And despite all the negative aspects of technology, we can see in some ways, they're assets to the degree that we use them for Krishna. I personally use, you know, all kinds of things to help me remember, you know, Kindle and one of those machines that have all the Prabhupada's lectures on it, and I find it very inspiring. Now, if you study Buddhism and Jewish texts, you'll see there's a prayer for almost every possible action and a perfect way of doing things in a similar way that we do things according to the Vedic texts. Most world religions, if you go back and back, you'll see they have similar, particularly Judaism, they have all kinds of, you know, okay, you're going to do this, but you have to do it at this time and exactly this way in order to get the right result. If you don't, then you're going to end up suffering in so many ways. Buddhism also has this sort of thing. So people get busy trying to avoid suffering by thinking, well, if I follow this rule and that rule and that rule around me, I'm going to save myself with a whole lot of suffering, which, if you think about it, Vyasadeva kind of wrote those instructions to help save people from suffering. There was in ancient times, there was a good lot of people, class of people, who spent a whole lot of time studying these wisdom texts with a view of guiding people in general. How can they live in harmony with Earth? And it included not only how can people live in harmony with the Earth or with natural law, but how to hold people accountable who didn't follow these rules that were actually natural laws and also God's laws. Even in early Christianity, like Vaishnavism, it was a kind of reform movement against the Jewish preoccupation, so many purity rituals and laws that completely missed the point of religious practice. And just like Lord Chaitanya, Jesus also said that the essence of all religion is to serve the Lord with all your heart and to love and serve people in the same way that you would love and care for yourself. So Vyasadeva originally wrote all these texts for those who were intellectually inclined, like the priests and the teachers of the age, which was at the end of Dwapara Yuga, which is the yuga right before Kali Yuga, which is what we're in now. And but when Vyasadeva noticed that the symptoms of Kali were increasing, that people were becoming more and more short-lived, and they had shorter memories, and they were becoming really merciless to others and to the planet and to other beings, he realized people didn't have the capacity to study all those rules and regulations. It was just not possible. They couldn't hold it, they couldn't study it, they couldn't focus it. And so, having compassion on humanity, Vyasadeva wove the essence of Vedic wisdom into the story of the Earth planet, which he embedded in Mahabharata, which is the essence of Vedic wisdom, the Bhagavad Gita. And in this way, through the use of story, Vyasadeva taught people what their duties in life were according to their life stage and their occupation. When you think about it, all this writing that Vyasadeva did must have taken a considerable amount of time. If anybody's ever tried to write a book, it's a big endeavor, editing and just getting the right words in the right place and being satisfied with it is a bearer. It's very difficult. But perhaps in that time it was easier for him to write than it is today. Maybe he had a better focused mind than ours that wasn't so distracted. But still, I can imagine how much energy he must have taken just to bring us this information. And after Vyasadeva finished writing what people needed to know in order to live in harmony with natural law and how they can have a successful material life, he thought to himself, after he finished all that, he thought to himself, you know what? My heart is not satisfied. Even after making all this wisdom available to the world, my heart still is unfulfilled. So he started to trace back, you know, as you would if you wake up one morning and you've just completed a project and you're thinking, gosh, I followed all my vows. What did I do wrong? I followed all my vows. I executed my deity worship. I respected all the spiritual masters. I wrote a guidebook for working class people in the story of Mahabharata explaining what they need to know. It was an act of charity. But in spite of doing all of that philanthropic work, I feel unsatisfied. There's just something missing. I don't know what it is. Perhaps I've not given sufficient directions about devotional service that is so revered by perfect souls. So just at that moment, as happens all the time, Narada Muni shows up. He tends to show up when people are a bit in crisis or they don't know what to do. If you notice in the Srimad Bhagavatam there, he shows up. And of course, he's the disciple of Narada Muni. And we are also in the lineage of Narada Muni. And so Narada shows up, and Vyasadeva gets up, and he quickly gives him a seat so to honor him. And so in the mood of Narada Muni, we can see Srila Prabhupada also who was descending in this lineage of Brahma, Madhva, Narada, Gaudiya, Sampradaya, he links us to Krishna in these transcendental time and space, and he can show up whenever he would like to, but he shows up whenever there's a crisis in a person or in human society. So we just have to become aware that even Sri Prabhupada, although we worship a form, he is actually transcendental to his body and is still present. So when we pray to him, we get reciprocation. We have this faith. So once Narada settles in his seat, he's aware already before Vyasadeva starts to speak. He's already aware, that's why he showed up, that he's struggling, that his heart is not fulfilled. And he starts to speak to Vyasadeva. He said, although you have prepared great, wonderful literary works, I know you're lamenting that your heart doesn't feel satisfied. And the reason is that you have not written enough about the purpose of the soul. You've spent all this endeavor teaching people how to manipulate the external material world, the material elements, so that they can somehow navigate living in it. You have completely forgotten or avoided or neglected to tell people about the soul. Most of what you have written in those books have focused on how people can become happy in the material world. It's basically a handbook for how best to worship the controlling deities who manage the material world so people can have their material desires fulfilled. We've written about healthy living and managing people, about skillfully waging warfare and the arts and sciences. But all this knowledge, while temporarily helpful, is mainly focused on how to live comfortably on the bodily platform. So your heart is not satisfied because you neglected to praise the glories of the Lord, who I suspect is not very pleased with your focus on these Vedic texts, he's telling Vyasa. Although you have repeatedly written about the four virtues, namely Dharma, Artha, Kama, Moksha, which is, it translates as righteousness, economic development, sense gratification, and liberation. You haven't done anything to teach people how to use all of that in the service of the Lord. Narada continued, that language that does not describe the glories of the Lord is like the sound of crows, and not very much appreciated by the swan-like devotees who are transcendental to the material world. Only words that are sung for the glorification of the Lord, even if imperfectly composed, are accepted by those who are purified and honest. Narada continued, despite being self-realized and free from material motives, transcendental knowledge does not look good without any love for the infallible Lord. So what good will all these Vedic texts do for the people who are working in this world unless they serve the Lord with it? So therefore, you should describe the Lord whose activities are supernatural. So he goes on and on about how someone who has forsaken his or her occupational duties in order to serve the Lord, they may fall down, even if they try. They fall down from their position because they're endeavoring to serve the Lord. But Narada says, but a non-devotee who is engaged in his or her occupational duties obtains nothing in terms of their real self-interest. So, in conclusion, Narada says, once a devotee acquires a taste for remembering the feet of the Lord, they will never want to give them up. So please give a description about the pastimes of him who is the most merciful. All learned scholars agree that the unmistakable purpose of everyone's austerities, studies, sacrifice, spiritual education, advancement, is found in reciting the descriptions of the transcendental qualities of Lord. So in the introduction of the Bhagavad Gita, Srila Prabhupada explains how the Supreme Personality of God is called Sat-Chit-Ananda. What does that mean? Does anybody know what that means? What do those three words mean? Yeah, I'll go.
Satyajanam, which is full of knowledge, and blissful.
Okay, Satyajanam, that's right. It's given in the Brahmasamhita, you know, the Ishwara Paramas Krishna Satyajananda Vigraha Nadir Govinda Sarvaparama. So Prabhupada explains that impersonal Brahman realization is the realization of Krishna's Sat, or eternity, feature. Paramatma realization is the realization of Sachi, or eternal knowledge, feature. But realization of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, is the realization of the transcendental features of the personality of God. So there are many religious paths that acknowledge the notion of eternity. That's not novel with Hare Krishna people. A lot of groups understand. Krishnas know this, that, you know, there's something eternal about the living being. Muslims know it. Buddhists know it, even though they are atheists. Jews know this. And even indigenous cultures understand that when the body dies, there's some aspect that continues. They may call it living energy, or living force, or they may call it spirit. And sometimes this eternal feature is understood as all-pervading light, or non-destructible energy force, which you don't need to be a theist to accept. My brother-in-law, who was a veterinarian, he understood there's some undestructible energy force underlying all of creation, but he didn't believe there was God. So it's totally possible for people to have this intellectual understanding of there's something eternal. Sometimes we understand this just as all-pervading light or love. I mean, different groups call it different things. The Quakers call it the inner light. So we would call this Brahman realization, to know this, and it means to perceive and accept an eternal principle that underlies creation. And then there's the chit feature, this realization that not only is there an eternal living energy force that pervades the creation, but that within the core of oneself and all other living beings, there is a source of eternal knowledge or wisdom coming from a higher source. And this knowledge is not things we know about, like material aspects of the world, like earth, water, fire, air, and ether. But it's knowledge of eternal truths about life that underlie material creation that have existed since time immemorial. For example, truths like nothing is permanent. That's considered to be an eternal truth, or wisdom. Everything that's created has a beginning, it grows, it remains for some time, dwindles and dies. And that would be for every aspect of creation. Or life is filled with suffering. I mean, that most religions will acknowledge that. People have enough experience of suffering to acknowledge that. Or that all people want to be happy. That's kind of a universal assumption. Everybody thinks, well, we all want to be happy. And all living beings grow old, even plants and cars and bugs, and they all grow, and everything dwindles and dies. So when we think of eternal knowledge, it's not just fact-finding or something, it's actually wisdom that is universal and eternal. So these existential truths, if you study them, you will see they are universally true for all living beings, regardless of a person's race, ethnicity, religion, culture, or species. Are there other universal truths that you might be able to name besides the ones that I have named? Can you think of any other ones? Oh, yeah. People suffer. Life is suffering. It's not permanent. People throw something out.
The truth will always become known, right?
What?
The truth, something, someone can try to hide something before sorrow, but
okay, could be. Okay, universal truth is the truth always wins in the end, maybe? What else? Is there any other truths that you can think of that might be considered universal? What? Speak louder.
That we are
the soul. That we are soul, or we're not the body. I'm not sure how many people really get that. I mean, I think that's an assumption we have about life. I'm not sure everybody, you know, even my Christian, the people I know, if you say something that, well, we're the soul, They'll think, I am a body, I have a soul, whereas we are thinking, I'm a soul, I have a body. So I'm not sure that's universal for everybody, but certainly for us, we would say that. So you might know so many truths about this world without experiencing joy. We really want to get to this joy piece. You may understand there's something eternal, there's eternal knowledge or wisdom, but that doesn't get you joy, just to know that. It's head stuff. It's cognitive. I know these things. I may theoretically even just know them. But we may not experience the bliss or the joy just because we have that knowledge. So Narada is saying to Vyasadeva, who is one of the gurus in our lineage, as I've said before, that if you want to have joy, you actually have to describe the glories of the Lord, who is the source of life. There's no other way. And so he kindly sat down, and he compiled the Srimad Bhagavatam, which we have on our shelves. And it's filled with stories of people and pastimes of those who gave up endeavors for righteousness and economic development and sense gratification and liberation, and they took complete shelter of devotional service. So in the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, we have all these stories of Krishna's appearance on earth in Vrindavan. And we may think that these stories are simply the history of Krishna and that Krishna is no longer appearing in our lives today. We may just think, we talk about it like it's, well, when Krishna was on the planet. But Lord Chaitanya affirmed in his appearance in 15th century that in this age of Kali, Krishna is appearing in the transcendental sound vibration of his holy name and the sound vibration of Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. And Prabhupada explains several places, but in one purport particularly, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, that because the Lord is on the absolute platform, there is no difference between the holy name of the Lord and the Supreme Lord himself. There are different names for the Supreme Lord, and the names have different purposes and meanings. For instance, he is known as Paramatma, the Supersoul, Brahman, the Supreme Absolute, Srishtikarta, the creator, Narayan, the transcendental Lord, Rukmini Ramana, the husband of Rukmini, and so on. And in this way, the Lord has many names, and these names indicate the Lord's different functions. So all the names of God are simply describing God's attributes, the all-powerful, the all-merciful, there's so many. The aspect of the Supreme Lord as the creator is different from the aspect of the Lord as Narayan. Some of the names of the Lord as the creator are conceived by materialistic men. People use that word all the time, the creator this, the creator that. It's kind of not a direct interaction with God. We're describing an external function of God. So Prabhupada is explaining that a person cannot fully realize the essence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead by understanding the name of the creator, because this material creation is a function of the external energy of the Lord. And therefore, this conception of God as the creator includes his external features. So, where I'm going with this, and I want to make sure we have time to discuss, is that when Lord Chaitanya was on the planet, he taught that the Lord is simultaneously one and different, and that he's present in the chanting of his holy name. So we don't really get that joy unless we're vibrating transcendental sound, either in the form of the holy name, or we are vibrating the sound of any transcendental literature. And that means we need to put ourselves or situate ourselves in a place or a circumstance where we can always be vibrating that pure transcendental sound. The process of going back to God, it has a lot to do with entering into a personal relationship with God. And we see all over the world now, the evangelical Christians are making an enormous amount of headway through just gathering together and singing. And you know, if you look, I don't know here, I think there's a, I forget the name of it, I saw them from America, but there's a group here called The Wine.
Yeah.
What is it? Hillsong, yeah, that's it. Yeah.
And Prime Minister is a member of
Yeah, But I don't doubt they are genuinely experiencing joy. I don't doubt it. I mean, they are appealing or addressing the Supreme Lord, who is not only within them but outside of them, in such a deep emotion. They don't do a lot of rituals or anything. That's their whole life practice, is singing. And we can learn from them because they are addressing, as they sing, they are addressing directly the Supreme Person, who they call Christ or Jesus. And that makes them, in some ways, a Vaishnava as well. We can, when we chant the holy name, we can reduce it to a mantra. You know, it is a mantra, it's true. In Eastern Orthodox traditions, they also they do what they call pray without ceasing. You know, that means their goal is to try to never stop praying. And they have a mantra which is chanted on beads like ours is, and they pray, "Dear Jesus Christ, have mercy on me, a sinner." And they're just focusing their mind on this notion of begging for God's mercy. And if you read some of their literature, you will see they have the same ecstatic experiences as many of our sages in our scripture, because they're giving so much focus and energy on addressing the person of Godhead. So it's very easy, we're chanting in Sanskrit, to forget the meaning of what we're saying. It's really a prayer when we chant. And learning how to actually sit and pray and address this transcendental person, and God is a person, and expect a response, is something that will bump your level of joy up another notch. Just chanting without addressing the Lord is a really different experience. And so what I'm here to kind of inspire, hopefully, is that when we are feeling conflicted in our mind, or depressed, or doubtful, or grumpy, you know, the mind is giving us a lot of trouble. What I have experienced, and what a technique I learned as a young devotee that helped me so much survive as a devotee in any circumstance, is when I am not feeling joy, or I'm feeling even worse than not joy, I'm just really feeling unhappy or unsatisfied or confused, I grab the closest book of Srila Prabhupada I can find, and I open it and sit down and read it out loud. I know we all like to read, and perhaps we read silently, but there's a real shift in being able to purify the dust in the heart that is there covering us by vibrating the sound with our mouth, because that sound vibration goes into the ears and into the heart. You can also sing bhajans, that's also oral vibration of transcendental sound. You can sing the holy name, you know, get out your kartals, just start chanting. What you will notice with an unruly mind, and I'd say we probably all have trouble with this, is that in the beginning, you may start reading if you like to read, or singing, or chanting out loud with your kartals, or even loudly with your japa beads, is in the beginning the mind is over here, and it's like a static in the background. You have that experience perhaps, and you may think, oh, you're reading silently, that this is a waste of time, I can't even get my mind, I'm reading the same paragraph over and over and over and over, and I'm not listening to it. But if you read out loud, that's the trick, your voice, the sound vibration, will preach to your mind. And if you read for 10 minutes, maybe 20 minutes, you just keep reading, you'll start to notice, I've experimented with this a lot, so I know that it works. The mind starts to, like a child, you know, who's pulling this way, and the mother's pulling this way, it starts to listen, and it calms down, and it starts to pay attention, and eventually, if you keep reading or chanting or singing, the mind will now join you in that focus. And now you're all on board, your mind, your intelligence, your false ego, everybody's listening to this transcendental sound. And I want to lift this up because it was such a transformative thing for me to realize that, oh, I can be joyful at any moment if I just get myself to vibrate transcendental sound. That's the trick. And we have so much literature now that we can pull from, even a little pocket book of Bhagavad Gita, prayers, you can learn prayers and start to sing them. But there's a big difference in doing that silently and doing it with sound. So I'm going to stop here to see if there are any comments or questions about this, or reflection. Yes?
Krishna's appearance 5,000 years ago, we have 90 stories in the 10th canto. And Krishna's name and Krishna is the same. Do we have any stories or pastimes of Krishna's name?
Pastimes of Krishna's name? You mean, well, if you read the Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's plenty of Leela around that. Huh? Yeah, all about it. If you read Chankasi, well, if you read some of Prabhupada's lectures, I have heard him, and probably Aniruddha and Chidhari, you probably heard of these as well, but Prabhupada, when he would talk about Krishna Leela, often he would make the point, he would make a parallel point of that this is the whole Hare Krishna movement is an incarnation of Krishna in this age, and he would talk about Krishna Leela in that context, that instead of in the past, that what's happening today is a reenactment of Krishna Leela here in the Hare Krishna movement. And so Prabhupada saw all his disciples as participating in this same Hari Nam Leela. So those stories are being created as we speak. Sankirtan stories of, you know, people who go out and, like I was telling a story about my husband who got attacked by somebody with an umbrella. Those are Leela, you know, how Lord Nishingadev comes in. But if you really want to hear stories about the holy name, you want to read the Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's tons. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah.
Saying that Krishna is Satchitananda, I was thinking how the way we have relationship, the way we communicate with him, the way we establish a relationship, we experience part of him. So those who worship Brahman or who try to attain Brahman, they attain only sub-portion.
Yeah.
Those yogis, they attain sub-portion and cheek with their only knowledge. But the bliss, the real bliss is to enjoy what is the topic of today is when you actually establish a relationship with Krishna. And there was one saying that was really nice. He said, God is not religion, God is a relationship.
Mm.
So when we establish that relationship, because he's Ananda, he's the source of all things, when we connect with him on that personal level as a person and we serve him and we establish that relationship, only then we get that full satisfaction, knowledge and bliss, all three features of Krishna.
That's right. Yeah, thank you. And yeah, you were done.
I've got a couple of questions. First one is, the other day you said incarnation of Krishna. Sometimes described as the literary incarnation. How do we, and so, if he's an incarnation of the Lord, then he should be Satchit Ananda.
Yeah.
Right.
Good point.
we find here that he's feeling existentially uncomfortable or ill at ease.
Yeah.
And has to be reconciled or instructed by his guru.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting in and of itself. So how do we reconcile the apparent contradictions here, where in the Supreme Personality of Godhead shows symptoms of emotions and feelings similar to an ordinary person.
Yeah, I'm going to say.
Huh?
I'm going to say. Everything that the Lord does is to set an example for human society. Just like, you know, Arjuna, what appears to be bewildered. And so it gives Krishna a chance to teach us by teaching him. So that would be my way of understanding Vyasadeva's apparent bewilderment if he's an literary incarnation of God. That he is giving Narada an opportunity to deliver us this information to human society Dharma, Artha, Moksha, and whatever the other one, Kama, it's not that we shouldn't know those things. What he's saying, you need to tell people how to use those things in my service. Whereas in the beginning, people just doing it for their service rather than for Krishna's service. So I think that the Vedic scriptures have meaning and they have light to give us. I think the main message Narada was giving is you need to use it or offer it in service to Krishna. That's what's missing. But to be honest, that would be the reason why I think that he would have instructed Vyasadeva is to set an example so we can hear it as a people. Unless you have a better idea. That's my hunch.
And it'd be similar maybe to Lord Chaitanya teaching us how to be perfect learning.
Yeah, by example. I mean, the Lord's always doing whatever he's doing. What a great man does, a small man follows, and all the world pursues. But I knew really you're puzzled. Keep talking.
I think it's, you're right. And also, it shows the personality of Godhead in a mood of compassion. Right. And that his intentions, his motivations, his concern is for the well-being of everybody. But he doesn't feel like he's fulfilled his mission entirely or completely. He hasn't completed the work that he set out to do.
Yeah.
Right? And so he's demonstrating the depth of compassion that Krishna and Krishna has it, and that's why the Chaitanya Charitamrita comes about.
Yeah.
And why the Bhagavatam is spoken,
right,
is to reveal the heart of the devotee, but also to reveal the heart of God.
Yeah. And what a wonderful thing that is, that God is not aloof. He cares so much.
He cares.
Yeah.
And, which brings me to the second question.
Yeah.
You mentioned that we may know the principles, theoretically know the principles, and know that the material world is not a nice place, and that we're eternal, and you're not the body, and the body goes through six stages, we know all that, but still inside, we still don't have the relationship that we want or that we need to be satisfied. Right? And, I was reading the introduction to Prabhupada's book the other day, and she made a comment that the goal of much of psychoanalysis and meditation and so forth is to become equipoised.
Mm.
But even in the pursuit of equanimity, if you like, or peace, we're still not satisfied.
Right.
We're not happy. And even you find devotees who have been practicing Krishna consciousness for many years, but they're still not happy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and we see in the Bhagavatam how kind of why the Bhagavatam is so important is because what's being revealed is the heart of a devotee and the heart of a Krishna.
Right.
And we want to enter into those relationships. They're the relationships that we want to enter into to get satisfaction.
Right, yeah.
We want to enter into a relationship with Krishna and with Krishna's devotees.
Absolutely.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do we do that? And of course the answer is, or at least what you said was, we need to hear pastimes, right? Or we need to be glorified the pastimes of Krishna. But sometimes we do that, still we're not happy. What's stopping us?
My experience is that it's not about just doing it. It's about putting our entire heart into it. So we're literally crying for that relationship. And it really has to be, it's a journey that goes from here down to here. You know, we really do have to make that journey and realize, I have no power to do this on my own. That I'm completely and absolutely dependent on your mercy to even know how to take my next breath. That we have to become that eager. I know, as a counselor, you know, I work with people who do the 12-step program, you know, people who are drug addicts, alcoholics, and they're really, really in trouble. You know, they have no power to free themselves from this addiction, and they have to get to that point. I have a niece who was an alcoholic for a while and went through the 12. You have to get to that point that I have no power. I can't do it on my own. And really call out. That's why I said in the Sunday feast, somebody objected in the back. But I said, well, if you call out, help me. Help me. I don't know what to do next. I'm confused and my back's against the place. I don't know how to love you. I don't even know how to chant. I don't know how to call your name. That Krishna will reciprocate with that level of depth. And something changes. The guy in the back said, but I've been doing that for 10 years and I didn't get my desire met. I didn't say that he would get his desire met. I said something good would happen, something different. So Krishna's waiting for us to really show that we want him in our life. And the Prabhupada said it's just a question of desire. The problem is we don't really desire it. He said, self realization is just take a second. You become completely enlightened in a second. But we don't desire it. Why don't we desire it? Because we know if we totally surrender our life to God, we may not like what God does with us. We don't trust, well, he may ask me to do this or that. I don't know. Krishna's not going to do something that way. But we don't trust, we really don't trust that Krishna's going to have our best interest in mind. But that's, for me, a daily process of just, I have no idea what my day will bring. I've stopped giving up. I've stopped making plans. That has been a big move for me in my devotional life as a person who have kids and you have to make a lot of plans. But at a certain point, I realized that as long as I keep making plans, I'm going to have anxiety. You know, I really do have to have a prayer of, Krishna, you show me the open all the right doors, close all the wrong doors. I have no idea what is your will. Show me what you want. And it's like a daily choice. And that's when the joy comes, because it's so many surprises. If you let Krishna manage your life, you're like, wow, I would never have thought to do it that way, you know, even with your material desires. Krishna has his own way in his own time of fulfilling your desires. If you just trust. But we have to go, we have to surrender first, and it comes.
Scary.
It is scary. It is scary. Because it's like jumping out of the Empire State Building. It's like, is there anybody going to catch me now? Yeah, anything.
What are apparatus?
Yeah.
Whenever we disturb anyone or we get disturbed, it's actually that's immediately material bondage. Because we cannot go to Krishna until we resolve. We know even the story about Rupa Goswami, who had a meditation, he was sitting, and he loved Krishna and Radha and Krishna because he was seeing the past, and but in the meanwhile there was
a crippled man walking by, and he thought about him.
And he thought that Rupa Goswami laughed at him. And his connection to Krishna, his ability to see these pastimes was ruined. And sometimes we don't, sometimes even small things, sometimes it's very difficult to how much we have to be careful.
Yeah.
Even unwantingly we can disturb others and not to speak when we are not careful how we express ourselves and what we say and what we say.
Right. True. That is how we have an artist, and we need to be aware and careful not to be offensive. I think sometimes we may be offensive, we don't know it. And so, what can be done? You always have to be apologizing.
How do you express yourself properly to be not offensive?
How do you
express yourself?
How do you express yourself more in general? Oh gosh, since we're going to answer that question. How do you address how you address people?
Express
yourself so you're not offensive.
Yeah, like I think it's like any time. Sometimes you can say something wrong. I guess you know, just say something and then just that's what he
expects. My experience is that if a person's intentions are not to hurt, it will communicate even if you mess up. We have people going as chaplains and they make a lot of boo-boos, you know, somebody comes in and they don't know all the techniques, there are certain skills and things to say and not to say, and they make a mess of it usually, but the patient always knows when their heart's in the right place. So if you mean or intend not to do harm, even if you say the wrong thing or you flub up, the person will know that you have not. And you can always back up. You can always just say, oh, that was a... Listen to yourself, but I just said, that came out of my mouth. Well, let me have a do-over. Let me back up a minute. I didn't mean to say that. That sounded hurtful. And that takes a lot of self-awareness to be able to notice how does it sound to you when you say something and you're going, wow, why did I say that? I didn't mean to say that. Be honest and humble and say it. You can always say, I didn't mean to say that. This is what I meant to say. And in this way, you can avoid. Well, let's try somebody else. We've had several questions. Yeah.
When Vyasadeva, he wrote all the Vedas, and we see that he's not content, he's not happy, satisfied. But Mahabharata is also part of the Veda, and in Mahabharata, Bhagavad Gita is there. So I'm just wondering that he wrote Bhagavad Gita, and which is also the word of the Lord, which is the only word of the Lord in all the scriptures. How come he's not content with that?
He was content. He wrote the Mahabharata. He wrote the Mahabharata after, no, Bhagavad Gita. He had the Vedas, and then he told him to write Srimad Bhagavatam. I guess that was it. I don't know. I agree with you. He wanted to know that why, if Bhagavad Gita was embedded in the Mahabharata, why Vedavyasa wouldn't have been content? Because he had glorified Krishna through that process. But
he wasn't satisfied.
That's for sure.
That's the reality. Why? Because he still hadn't focused on Krishna's pastimes.
That's right. Yeah.
That's that culminates in the 10th canto of Bhagavatam.
Right.
And of course all the 9 cantos that come before to condition the heart of the devotee so that they can understand that.
So I guess that when he's right, when you go to the Mahabharata, he embedded the duties of people in different stages and occupations in the Mahabharata. The Gita also is a philosophical treatise, but the sweetness comes from entering into that personal relationship.
Bhagavad Gita is A, B, C. It's
yeah.
It's the prime.
Right.
And the I guess, Prabhupada says that the Bhagavatam is like the graduate course. Chaitanya Charitamrita is like the postgraduate. And so you get, it just, Prabhupada sometimes says, the Bhagavad Gita ends with surrender to Krishna. And how do you surrender? That's in the fourth chapter. Approach a spiritual master and learn the process of bhakti through the guru. So in one sense, but that's it. There's some information about how to come into Loja, but not the kind of, in the Bhagavatam, you see the heart of a devotee.
And the reciprocation that's happening. Yeah, it's kind of a one-way thing.
You get the same thing on like Ami Maharaj is a demon. Vritrasura, who's a demon.
Yeah.
If he's a great devotee.
Yeah.
We're not speaking of great devotees, we get, we see it. So you see all of this devotion, plus you see also the reciprocation in Krishna. And then you get the 10th canto, which is just all, and especially in Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan, which you consider really, like the epitome of it all. So there's a lot there. So it's there in the Mahabharata. But it's kind of in a seed form in the Bhagavad Gita, it's not fully manifest.
Right.
Then when you get the Bhagavatam, you get the truckloads of it.
Right. Go ahead. I don't know how long we need to stop. I guess people need to go when they need to go. Go ahead.
Hare Krishna, Mataji. First of all, thank you so much for such a wonderful class. Especially your kirtan in the starting, when you started with art. It was very, very touching and very mellifluous, I should say. The topic that you started was joy in Krishna consciousness. And I was just trying to really analyze the word joy. In my understanding, for an individual, like a male, let's say, gender, his joy could be serving his son, or his daughter, when they want anything, even if it gives pain to himself. Just serving can give him joy. But the same individual, when he goes to his office, he would want his employees to be served. That is what gives him joy when they listen to him. So the word joy becomes all about more surrender. If you are surrendered to somebody, then you serve and you get joy. And which comes to the principle of Sharanagati, where there are six principles, the humility, the Atmanivedan, thinking that Krishna is the protector. And that always will come only when you have sambandha, like, the father has a relationship with the child as sambandha. So, going convolutedly, the question is, how to build this relationship with Krishna? Because even after years of being in Krishna consciousness, we still tend to look as Krishna as the Lord. We don't look as a friend or anything. Because we look at him and we pay our humble obeisance, we ask for his mercy. It's more still in awe and reverence, because I still think, Guru Maharaj is representative of Krishna, or Krishna, right? So the Sharanagati is happening more from the perspective of, like you stated, being in part as feeling miserable, not as a sambandha, where you start serving with the love, and that is why the joy is probably not coming. So could you elaborate, or could you reflect on it, or elaborate and discuss?
Well, I think that what I was trying to get at in this particular talk was that that our relationship develops, and we can taste the sweetness to that degree that we vibrate or glorify Krishna, even if we don't feel it in the beginning, that it's really about cleansing the dust in the heart. And the more we do that by reciting, explaining, doing, it's not enough just to hear, but also to explain or to write or do something, then we start to know the mind of Krishna, and it creates intimacy, because we are so aligned with Krishna through sound and through remembering, that we feel that sambandha, that we feel that relationship, particularly when we start to do what Krishna is telling us, or Srila Prabhupada is telling us in the purports of his books. I mean, there's a lot of instructions as you read Chaitanya Charitamrita about sharing this knowledge with others and doing what you've seen your guru do. To that degree, we do actually do those things. To that degree, we understand the mind of our guru. And then we can really feel their presence all the time. Always guiding, always blessing, always. I mean, that's my experience isn't until I took on the responsibility of trying to share the message that Srila Prabhupada gave me. And I do it only because he told us to do it, that I really feel close to Prabhupada. You know, I've been in the movement 50 years and I've probably done every service there is to do. But it wasn't until I took a risk to try and actually do what he's telling us to do in all areas. And he's telling us we need to preach Krishna consciousness in some way, whatever capacity we have, but mostly to tell others, to explain the philosophy. And as we chew it up, Krishna gives us intelligence, Prabhupada's giving us intelligence, and you feel them right there and very close to you. And I think that's, for me, what I would tell you. You know, that it's not that if you're a Prabhupada disciple, you have access. It's not true. Every one of you sitting here have direct access to Srila Prabhupada by reading his books and just doing what they say. But it starts with hearing and reciting and understanding, and then going ahead and doing it. It's part of our sadhana. That's why we preach, because if we don't preach, Maya preaches to us. So you're either going to be on the receiving end with Maya, you know, getting you in a corner, or you're going to be going this way. But that's when you start to take on the mantle of the parampara, and you start to understand the mind of Narada Vyasa. It starts to come to you. And now you have the responsibility of passing that on to someone else. Yeah. Oh.
So I was just going to ask one question about joy. Because joy in the dictionary definition is like an emotion of delight or happiness that you feel by doing something. So for devotees, sometimes, because there's nine processes of surrender, and so they're the activities that we would do in that emotional practices. So from those, it doesn't necessarily mean that everyone can get a joy or delight out of just doing one particular aspect of that more than another, so that someone might feel like the joy of serving might be a lot more satisfying and lifting their emotions. Someone might think it's chanting Hare Krishna. Someone might think it's preaching. Can that happen?
Well, what I understand from Prabhupada is that even the deity worship and all the aspects of deity worship need to be accompanied by hearing and chanting. And if that is not accompanied by hearing and chanting, it becomes a burden. We start to feel it as a burden. So it's not to say that you wouldn't have a passion for garlands and earthquakes and doing all of that. Prabhupada did say, I mean, he's said it many places, that the deity worship has to be accompanied by sufficient hearing and chanting, or we will feel it a burden in due course of time. And that's why in the old days, I guess in the movement when we didn't have many people, you would have, when somebody was putting the pajamas on Krishna, somebody would be sitting in front of the altar reading Krishna book. And in this way, the pujari would be not just putting Krishna to bed, but also hearing the pastimes. And we had like five different times a day where you would pause and hear something, you know, after Mangalarti, and then we had Bhagavatam class in the evening before. You know, you have this hearing going on, because that's what we're here about. It's an educational center to train people, but mostly in getting a taste for hearing and chanting. You know, like you've got the Panchamukhi Bidhi that you described, but then there's the Bhagavad Bidhi. And the Panchamukhi Bidhi is very much dependent on the Bhagavad mark, but the Bhagavad mark can stand alone. Even if you have no deity worship, you know, you can invoke Krishna's form just by sound. That's the way I would see it. But it doesn't mean that you wouldn't find joy and bliss. But in my experience, it's really the bliss and the joy increases the more we become absorbed in hearing. You know, you put a tape on a prophet while you're making garlands or sewing outfits. That makes it very much more nectar to hear in the pujari room and in the kitchen, you know. Put an iPod on and some earplugs, or get somebody to read to you while you're doing your service.
Yeah. Just when you were talking about the chanting before, we were on a Japa retreat just recently, and one of the points that stuck in my mind about Japa was to chant in the mood of receiving rather than achievement.
Nice. Yeah.
Achieving something.
Receiving. I like that. It's a relationship, not just a process. It is a relationship. We are appealing and receiving. Yeah. Thank you. Who is that? Borijan? And Satchinanda Swami? Yeah. Yeah.
So, here you send this point, much the japa is in the mode of receiving. Can you know it?
Well, she made the point, but you want to say something more? Because she was just at the retreat. He wanted to know if I could elaborate more on this notion of receiving. But since it was your point, maybe you have something more you want to share.
So that you're not chanting your rounds and trying to get your rounds done, or that you're trying to achieve something, that, oh, one more round to God, or you're starting to kind of think about what you're going to achieve with your japa. You go into the mood of a relationship with Krishna, seeing him as a person, and that you're going, like you're saying, crying out for mercy because you're not in this whole situation.
Yeah, and it sounds to me like what you're describing is a shift in the mood of doing chanting for my efforts. Like, you know, sometimes people really get like a machine gun, you know, you think I can capture Krishna that way by all my effort. You can't. It doesn't work like that. You have to empty yourself and depend on Krishna and pray that he will appear. Yeah, thank you for that. That's a great thought. Okay, are we ready to go to bed and get up tomorrow and do it all again? Okay, good night. Take care. See you in the morning.
I'm doing something.